What's going on, good people? This is DJ Ambush. You're listening to the Numbers 96.7 FM, Portland's only black-led radio station, and this is North to the Numbers. If you are a subscriber, if you're a follower, if you've been engaging, you know what North of the Numbers is. It's our podcast where we host different interviews, different conversations relevant to Black Portland. You'll have different hosts throughout the entire series. I try to keep my voice out of everything. But, yeah, I'm very, very happy to be able to be a part of this conversation right here. So if anyone has listened to me on Run Up the Numbers, on Podcast Has No Name, on Unrefined Sophisticates, I would not be someone who would be clearly identified as pro-cop, just from the rip. Grew up in Philadelphia, moved out here 6 years ago. Just our overall experiences with law enforcement, it differs from region to region. It differs from neighborhood to neighborhood. And it differs also based on a couple of different lines, dealing with gender, dealing with sex, dealing with race, dealing with age. I definitely found myself getting pulled over a lot less the older I got. So I don't know if that says what that says about my decision making. But with any of these systems, with any of these institutions in which we as citizens are having difficulties navigating or have a contentious relationship with, the idea is that it would take people on the inside to make a change. People on the inside of these organizations to see the issues, communicate what the community needs to do, communicate what type of support they need to bring us to a place where we can move forward in a more amicable way. And I'm hoping that that's what we're going to be seeing throughout this conversation I'm having with Captain Derek Peterson. First off, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. One of the things that really really enticed me to have this conversation with you is that you're born and raised here. Portland, Oregon has a very, very interesting history. Portland is the whitest city in America. 15 minutes outside of the metro area, you will see Confederate flags. You'll see any number of things. And it's unfortunate that even the American flag has a different meaning than it used to 6 years ago. But talk to us a little bit about your upbringing here in Portland, and then what brought you to law enforcement.
Yeah, so very interesting. I come by way of Tuskegee, Alabama.
Okay.
My parents were born and raised in Tuskegee. People have heard about the Tuskegee Airmen
and
George Washington Carver and all those great black men and women that have come from such a great, great state, mm-hmm. and a great city, a small city as Tuskegee, Alabama. So my parents made their way out west,
okay.
to strike it out on their own, to be independent, and ended up in Vanport like a lot of other black folks, mm-hmm. that came this way. And mm-hmm. my dad worked in the shipyards after he was in the war, and then he had several kids out here, me being one of them, mm-hmm. and this has been my home since. So okay. that's what I know. I have made my way back to Alabama, and it does take a little while for him to warm up to me, but I said, we are family. Come on now. So once everything is cleared and mm-hmm. they figure out, yeah, you're okay, it's on, and out comes the food and the chitlins and all the other stuff. So yeah, we don't forget where we came from.
So when you say once everything is clear, like what is that like? What lens is even your family viewing you through initially?
Come on, you hear my voice.
Right.
Sounds pretty white. So it takes them a minute to make some adjustments and go, right. He's family. We're gonna just settle right there, and then once that's over, we start dancing and doing some things. It's like, oh,
okay.
Okay. Yeah.
It's still Derek, y'all. It's all right. Okay. So on your journey to where you are today, law enforcement, at what point did you even start looking towards this career? Was it high school? Was it like, you know, at what point did you start gaining interest? And what were the triggers? What were the catalysts?
Well, let's just say that going out of high school, I didn't have a lot of direction.
Okay.
I was just trying to get out of high school and hopefully get into a college somewhere. And actually, I wanted to get into possibly the ministry. I was going to go to college at West Coast Bible College,
okay,
play some basketball, and, you know, like most folks, want to get away from your family, get away from those ties. And I ended up, my dad ended up asking me to stay home, and I grew up too fast, and I'm the youngest of five. So he says, you grew up too fast, man. I'd like you to stay around. So I honored my father, and he ended up passing away a couple of years later, and I ended up taking care of my mom and staying home and went to Portland State University.
Okay.
So trying to find my way through that process was very interesting, and I had several people from Portland State who poured into me to give me some direction as to where I might want to go.
Mm-hmm.
Got into the criminal justice field. Fell in love with that particular field, and it kind of spoke to me and my talents and what I could do. And I ended up doing a practicum in Washington County Probation and Parole. A lady by the name of Maura Goodman, a white lady that, and it really doesn't matter whether she's white or black, she poured into me.
Right.
Allowed me to be hands-on with the people that were coming out of the jail system, the prison system. And I saw how she treated people with such respect and at some of the lowest times of their lives and trying to give them direction. And I was like, that's what I want to do.
Mm.
And so when I was done with the practicum, I immediately was trying to get into jobs that were similar to that, probation and parole. And I ended up at the sheriff's office as a corrections officer, had no clue what that journey was going to produce. But within that process, once I figured out that I had a chance to make a difference in a different way, I latched onto it and actually started to move up the ranks from regular corrections officer. I was hired as a corrections officer all the way up to chief deputy in the organization running the corrections division. So it's been an interesting journey.
So when you said you spoke to that woman that poured into you that inspired you, creating opportunities for you to be hands-on, kind of following in some of the examples that she gave. What did that look like to you? What were some of the things that she was doing that surprised you as far as how she was addressing and dealing with that population? And then what did being hands-on in that time period mean to you? What were some of the objectives that you placed for yourself?
Well, first thing is that she brought humanity out. I mean, that was huge for me because that's the at the core of my being a person of a deep, rich heritage of religion, of Christianity, to pour out your heart in that way without even having these walls up. It was amazing to see that and how she interacted. So it came right in line with who I am, who I was at that particular time. And then going further into the situation of what would that actually look like? And like, I kind of forgot some of the last part of your question, but.
Yeah. So, I mean, and you're heading that direction anyway. Yeah. What does that look like as far as the things that you wanted to do and the way it affected you addressing those particular situations, dealing with that particular population? I mean, there's a level of cultural competency that we have when we look and see our own people. We're able to relate a lot better to whatever could have brought them to this particular circumstance.
Right. So this has been what I call a journey.
Mm.
So I didn't know a lot about criminal justice. You're fresh out of college.
Mm.
You know a little bit, but you don't know the numbers. You don't know how it's affecting the black community, all communities, and how it's coming together in that sense. And really culminating to this point where I got into corrections and started looking at those numbers and understanding that there was a disproportionate of, of black people in jail and, mm-hmm. and some of the issues that were going around that, the laws that at that point, Measure 11 was extremely at a high point, and you were seeing a lot of black people going away for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm.
And so that disproportionate situation and issue started to really hit me in a way where, what was I going to do within the within that system?
Mm.
And so what ended up really happening is just being myself was the key. Mm. I didn't have to really reinvent or do some things. It was being respectful to everyone, and especially those who that looked like me.
Right.
And the results of that, I couldn't even have thought in a million years what would have happened. But as I started... Mm. to raise up through the ranks, I actually had young black men, or the black men that I actually were growing up with behind the four walls, basically, right, applauding me for my promotions.
Mm.
I would actually have people in the community that were in the jail system would come up and walk up to me and say, "Hey, I'm doing well. Thanks for reaching out to me, or treating me fair, treating me with dignity, treating me with respect. When I wasn't doing right, you corrected me, but you did it out of a caring heart to that mm-hmm. extent." So I started to see what this really kind of looked like, and it projected me to continue to promote up and see what I could do on a policy level, on a city level, on a county level, whatever it might be.
Mm-hmm.
And so things started to started to come to me as organizations that I started to associate with, whether it's Police to Peace or even the Portland Rotary,
mm.
seeing what they were doing. Even though it's a lot of white people doing stuff, but they are like so in tune with what's happening. I couldn't just sit by and go, I can't stand by anymore
and
not be active in trying to reduce the jails, the prisons, those kind of things, but hold people accountable on top of it. There has to be an accountability issue that goes down with this, that people need to respect each other to that extent. So that's kind of the nuts and bolts of it, where I finally got to.
So with... You talked about, as you were ascending in the ranks, that you had members of the population of our community that were congratulating you. And I can imagine in those moments, you may have felt somewhat like a unicorn, because in the way that that's not our normal relationship with members of law enforcement. What did, outside of, you know, being in those moments and, you know, accepting those accolades, what did that mean for you when you look at the rest of policing? The fact that you, just approaching people from a very human standpoint, is the anomaly that we celebrate. What did that mean for you in those times?
Well, so you those are validation points, right? And so you do a mild marker check, as I would call it, milestones, and how that was relating. And as the other piece of it, I've been teaching diversity for 25 years.
Okay.
Down at the academy.
Okay.
Trying to make some inroads with new hires coming on. And we know that the state is mostly white to that extent, right?
Right.
So how was I going to be able to interact with all people to that extent, right? So that's where I started to see how bringing this humanistic quality, not only to the people of color, the people that I associate with, but also the people that are white, that are wanting to be allies. And how do you bring them into those situations? And
for anyone joining the conversation, we are live at the Welcome Dome at Pioneer Square. Pioneer Square is Portland's living room. So you will hear some conversations in the background, and you know, but this is what it is. This is part of the Black Podcast Festival series. down here at the Welcome Dome. Go ahead.
Yeah, so just to carry on, it's that the diversity part of it, setting up an atmosphere that allowed people to express themselves. This is kind of a carryover from being in corrections and being in those pods or modules with various people from all walks of life, whether it's you talked about it.
Yeah.
You know, black, white, green, purple, blue, yeah. and everything under the sun
yeah.
Of those folks. So how are you relating to it? So what it really did for me is taught me how to break down situations regardless of what walk of life you came from. Mm. And the real situation, if you bring people into a place where they can be comfortable enough to have that conversation, a real conversation about who they are and to reflect on the issues or the influences that they've had on that have been that have had they've had it, the influence that they've had on their life to that extent, whether it's parenting, whether it's sports, the schools you went to, teachers, having a Coke or a Pepsi.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
I break it down so far down. What military were you in? Whether it was the Army or the Navy.
Right.
And why do you, which armed forces is the best? We all have these things that we think that shape us, right? And we don't realize at the end of the day, how did it really shape us to the extent to, I look at my parents. They were born in 1918 and 1919, right?
Completely different worlds.
Yeah, they were raised by parents that were slaves.
Right.
So that influenced me, and I had no idea why they were doing what they were doing. And so even my kid, I'm looking at him, I'll say something to him, and he goes, "Dad, what are you talking about?" It comes way back to
right.
my dad bringing me up
right.
from those days that he actually had a grandfather who was burned alive by the KKK, right? So those are the perspectives that you don't realize until you're a little bit older. You start to have some of these conversations that I've had to have, and then I start processing, what does that look like for me?
Right.
So it gets deep.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I'm giving you kind of a snapshot of what I've been able to do over a 25-year period, really having major conversations with all types of people and going, hey, so now where do we go?
Right. So, I mean, you're no stranger to the population looking at law enforcement as a monolith. The angle that you've taken in your career so far has been unique in the way, at least from what I'm hearing now, has been unique in the way that you make a point to humanize everyone that you come in contact with and find that commonality, not just in the things that were contributing factors to the decision that they make, but just how, like you said, like what part, what member, what section of, what department of the military were you in? There's a commonality there. Coke or Pepsi, there's a commonality there. What's the football team you root for? There's a commonality there. Finding ways to connect. You mentioned something about accountability and respect. Again, it's one step for us to be able to see members of law enforcement as people, especially when we don't know them, if it isn't someone that we grew up with in our community. And I can tell you, I have had friends that once they became law enforcement, we weren't friends anymore. Simply because of our personal interactions, I saw those interactions change. So, you know, for that, I kind of chalked it up to some of the systemic pressures of their job and the location of that job. But in an effort to, again, be able to see each other as these individuals, accountability and respect is extremely important. One of the issues citizens have is accountability on the side of law enforcement. What are your views on that, and how do you address those concerns for those of us that feel like, okay, when law enforcement steps out of line, we don't see accountability from the outside. There may be some measures on the inside that we're unaware of, but from the outside, we don't see the accountability we're looking for. This is a particular career where you actually have the ability. It's within your purview to take someone's life. So the expectations for accountability for us as citizens is like, I couldn't get away with this on my job, you know? So, yeah, jump into that for me.
Yeah, so we need to be held to a higher standard. There's no doubt about that.
Okay.
And I don't think any of us have a problem with it to the extent that we understand truly that we can take a life, right?
Mm.
And if you don't have that sense, you shouldn't be in the business.
Mm.
And it's up to management, it's up to officials to set up parameters to find people in these organizations that aren't respecting that high calling. And that's what I'm about, is are you in a position that you see what is expected of you within the community? And you talked real, I think it's very interesting what you were saying, is that holding our folks, law enforcement, accountable, and how the community has a chance or opportunity to really understand that that's actually what's happening behind closed doors. That's the process of opening up law enforcement to the community.
Mm.
Listening to the community and saying, because I could tell you right now, if I went down to talk to folks in the community right now and said, hey, so what does holding law enforcement personnel accountable, what does that look like? I guarantee you it's all in our policies, right?
Mm.
But they don't know that's what's in our policies, and they don't see that process happening. So they left up to their own imagination. They're going, well, you all ain't taking care of anything. Because what I see it on the other end is this person's kind of looked like they got away with it.
Yeah.
But there's so many other components to the issues of discipline and progressive discipline that the average citizen doesn't know. And then you put in a union aspect to it.
Yep.
And some other elements, and then it looks like things are real shady.
Yeah.
Right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I get that. But if we're not, as law enforcement, saying, how do we open up to the community to see what we actually are doing and how we hold people accountable, you're gonna be left up to your own imagination to that, and that has to stop.
Yeah, that the transparency is completely necessary.
Yes, transparency.
Yes. So I'm gonna tell you, back home, state troopers, sheriffs, police, we look at them as completely different entities that require a different type of interaction every single time. You're in the sheriff's office. Why that as opposed to the police department? Well, what was the
real
choice?
Simple?
Uh-huh.
First job that came up, right?
Okay, all right.
I'm gonna make it real simple for you, but here's the deal: you don't know what you got until you got it. So the pasture is not always greener on the other side, right?
Right.
So I've been in business for 35 years in the correction side, and have been respected in a lot of ways to really have a voice for law enforcement as a whole.
Okay,
whether it's Janelle. Representative Bynum giving me opportunity to sit on committees that around police reform and actually speak to it. So I may not have a credential of have gone down to the academy to get a law enforcement certificate, but I've been asked over and over again to represent law enforcement, especially when you see what has transpired with the protests that took place for a large period of time here in Portland. So I was in the Emergency Operations Center, so I could see that. I had been a tactical commander for our tactical team and hostage negotiation team. So I have aspects of law enforcement that interweave, even though I haven't been on the street. And people are asking me for that opinion about what does munitions look like and why should we be allow you to be able to use those, and all those different components that our law enforcement are dealing with on a daily basis. So I'm going down a rabbit hole, but those are the situations and issues when I looked at going into to be a Portland police officer. I tested 3 or 4 times, right? I'm trying to leave, get out of corrections. I'm done, right?
Right.
So because that's usually the next stepping stone is getting on the road.
Mm.
I was number two on the list for about a year and a half for the sheriff's office to go on the road, and they expired the list. So it wasn't through lack of trying. So I always say when God closes the door, you better kind of finally figure out
right.
and recognize, right?
Right?
So the doors continue to close. And so I finally stopped looking.
Mm.
And that's when I found a place in the correction side of the house that allowed me to be able to be not only a voice for corrections, but a voice for law enforcement as a whole.
Mm. Okay. For anyone that doesn't, you mentioned Measure 11 a little bit earlier. I just want to just dip back to that real quick. For anyone that's unfamiliar with what Measure 11 is, could you explain that and the impact Measure 11 has had on the community?
So Measure 11 came about because citizens felt that judges weren't being fair when they were handing out sentences, right?
Mm-hmm.
Especially the black and brown people. So they felt that if this law came about where there was mandatory sentencing, it took the power out of the judge's hands.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't say, well, Joey did so-and-so, and these are Measure 11 charges are person-to-person crimes, murder down to rob one and two,
okay.
Rape, some of these high-end person-to-person crimes. And so what it ended up doing is everyone was getting either five years or nine and a half years, something like that, regardless of who you were, whether you were black or white, took all the power out of the judge's hands based off that. So that's really generally what Measure 11 was about.
Okay. That's a very interesting way. I've never heard it explained that way. I mean, there were aspects of it that definitely familiar that you said. As far as removing the race component from the judge's decisions, that I've never looked at it from that perspective before. The effect on the effect that Measure 11 still had in our community based on who's being picked up, though, right? We're still looking at a higher percentage of our folk that end up in front of the judge. So, of course, there's something that needs to happen at the street level and where there needs to be a more even hand, a more even eye on the way we're handled by law enforcement, the way we're handled by that community. So, okay, thank you. Thank you for that explanation.
Yeah, not a problem. Yeah.
I've never gotten it from that angle, from the judge's side. I would definitely like, there's a couple of the places I want to jump into, but I want to talk about Noble.
Voting?
Noble?
Noble? Yes.
Noble.
I'm
sorry.
I can't.
Yeah.
Yeah. Can't hear sometimes.
Compete with the trolley right there.
All right.
I want to talk to you about Noble, a national organization of black law enforcement executives. Tell me about this. I've never heard of Noble before.
Yeah, so we're out here, I'll call it the Wild Wild West, especially in the northern part. So Noble's been around since 1976.
Okay.
Several executives, black executives, got together in Washington, D.C. Back in that time period. And they were going to all these conferences and these different places, and they finally met. I'm being real quick about it, but
yeah.
They finally met together and was like, why can't we have our own organization? What would that look like? And so they hammered out kind of a quasi group of what they called Noble at that particular time.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, executives, high-end executives, chiefs of police from across the country. And Noble was born to assist black officers, black command officers, to help them get through those processes where there were roadblocks, constant roadblocks happening. If you think of 1976, what was happening, to be a black man, to have that opportunity, a black woman, have the opportunity to raise up the ranks, extremely difficult, right? So it came about in that fashion. So we have over 60 chapters nationwide and 3,000 members worldwide.
Mm.
And we really act as the consciousness of law enforcement and how it interacts with the community. And so it's prevalent back east, not necessarily in the Northwest.
Okay.
We have a lot of chapters in California. We actually have a regional president that's in Alaska, a brother that's a state trooper, fantastic man that takes care of business. So it's hidden here in Portland in the Northwest. And so that's what I've been trying to do as its president for the last 6 years, is really try to reestablish its brand and what it looks like, not only here in the Northwest, but because it's a different.
Oh yeah,
it's completely different, right?
Yeah,
compared to the East Coast, because them brothers and sisters back there, they got it going on. I'd love for us to have that kind of camaraderie and the ability to affect a community like they do and have a major voice. So we've been able to establish a little bit of a beachhead, but it doesn't seem sometimes to stick as well as it could. If I was able to become sheriff, I would think that they would pour in a lot of resources coming out this way to be prevalent in our community, bring resources that aren't available to Portland in different ways, whether it's civilian oversight, that they have a great program that encompasses that brings community into the oversight situation, so that community does feel a part of law enforcement and being heard and listened to. So that's Noble in a nutshell.
Okay. Yeah, I'm glad you started talking about some of the resources, because I was going to ask you, you know, as the current president, what are some of the things that maybe some of the reoccurring issues that you're hearing from state to state from all of your members that law enforcement, that black law enforcement is dealing with?
Well, really, it's always been a diversity type of situation where do you have, again, Portland is a lot different.
Of course.
When you're trying to recruit a diverse workforce. It's not a problem when you go to New York and different places down the Eastern Seaboard per se, but how? But it still is difficult regardless, because the culture of law enforcement and the institutional racism built inside of it really makes it difficult for people of color to get through those ranks even today, right? So how do you bring forth a program or strategies that prepare young black men and women to be able to get into these positions of authority and power to make those actual changes? So that's a huge part of it, is that retention, the recruiting, the training is a big aspect of it. More DEI training or diversity, equity, and inclusion training is needed. But I tell people at this point, 25 years of teaching diversity, I'm done with diversity 101. I'm tired of getting to first base and then I'm out going back to the dugout.
Right.
We need to round first base, go to second and third.
Right.
And that's those heavy conversations. So that's what I'm trying to push, is take off the gloves.
And I can imagine that there is a great deal of pushback while you're trying to push that. For you to bring up institutional racism, for a lot of us, it's like, you know, duh. But I know that there are members outside of our community that just don't believe it's there, based on their cultural experiences with law enforcement. It's like, what are you talking about? You know, just comply and you won't have to have an issue. So when, as a member of law enforcement, and you're having these conversations with some of your colleagues, first off, how often are those conversations just, you know, happening? And what is it? What is that pressure? What does that pushback feel like?
Well, those conversations don't happen. Like I said, we need to get off of diversity 101.
Okay.
And make that turn around to second base. And so for me to have those conversations, especially down at the academy, that's my opportunity because I've got a captive audience. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. They're not going anywhere. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important that we face our situations with dealing with our government officials and people who of authority and power to let them know that if we're not having those robust conversations, they talk about it all the time. We should have robust conversations. And you never have them.
Right.
And I think people are getting woke to an extent. You use that term woke, and what does that look like? And but for those who don't believe that there is institutional racism, I'm a product of it, of having to go through those processes where I have to think about each process, how people are looking at me, what they're thinking, how I'm acting, how I'm walking, how am I being perceived, mm-hmm. right?
Right.
The other people don't have to do that.
Right.
They just go along life as it's okay. It doesn't matter, right?
Right.
So I'm constantly having to check myself. That's part of institutional racism that is hard to define. But as a black man having to go through these processes of scrutiny with a lens that they put on you, mm-hmm. that's institutional racism.
Right.
Because I have to think about it every day.
Right.
And those processes, right? And then you have people who will come to you and say, well, I believe in diversity, I believe in inclusion and all these kind of things and equity, and we're going to put an equity lens on it. Well, fantastic. I love it, but the end result doesn't get us to the table where people are saying, well, so what do you think about it, Derek? What's your perspective? And I have to be the one in the room going, well, am I going to be the black guy to have to say this, right? Why wouldn't you ask me? I'm at your table.
Right.
And one of maybe one or two that are at the table, well, one, right?
Yeah.
They're at that table, per se, and not having that opportunity. So I'm always having the way, should I say something? Is it worth it? Is this the battle I need to fight right now, wow. today? Or do I just, we'll just wait to that extent. So you're always having to measure and weigh what your presence in the room can do, and then at the end of the day, you go home and said, "Did I fail? Should I have said something?"
Yeah, that is it worth it is a tough one,
right?
The choosing when and how to appear in those circumstances is tough.
Yeah,
because you spoke earlier about some of the pressures and challenges as you're trying to rise through the ranks, and the institutional racism that you face from the career standpoint. We have, I feel like the public has an idea, maybe a very, limited idea of what you all could be facing. People of color, black people specifically, while in this career, we have an idea. But when we talk about institutional racism, we look at how it affects us on the outside.
Right.
And in the training that you're doing, these conversations that you're having, it's tough for us to even think that one, that those conversations are even happening, because we don't feel like we're seeing the results of law enforcement learning these lessons and even, growing with us through the times. Some of the behavior that we've seen has kind of come back. Eric Adams, prime example for me. The fact that he put stop and frisk back on the table was wild for me. I graduated high school in 94. My parents are immigrants, very strict household. And I remember having a conversation with my father about stop and frisk and Eric Adams bringing that up while he was running. And he was like, well, yeah, that's how it needs to be done. And I was like, Pop, the emotional trauma, the mental trauma of being stopped by police unnecessarily. You've never experienced that. You've never had a summer of 6 and 7 stops for nothing. Like, it it directly affects how free you feel just leaving your house. There are people that are going to hear this, this particular conversation, and not be able to relate to what it means to see the flashing lights and your body just tense up. And now you're in a state of, you know, fight or flight. And but at the same time, your decisions are very limited, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's as you're dealing with institutional racism on the inside, with some of the changes that you're trying to make, how much progress have you seen with what we're facing on the community side? And what hope do you have?
I think there's been major progress, and when you talk about Portland Police specifically, the Sheriff's Office enjoys a different kind of environment, but Portland Police has been under decrees and consents and all kinds of different situations that have forced them to really change. And interacting with especially some of these the white officers and especially command staff, you see a level of understanding that I think the community should be extremely proud of. And as you look at the end result, I understand that there's still issues out there, but you have their attention. The city, the citizens, and what they're asking, they're attentive, understanding, and trying to do their best to shift that process of how people are looking at them, because they know they're under a microscope, and they don't want anybody that represents them, white or black, to go down a road to make it harder on them to that extent. So, like any culture, there's 1 or 2% within that culture. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you've heard it time and time, I'm sure, over again.
Oh yeah.
And you go, really? You
just a couple of bad apples?
Come on now. But they represent somehow they represent everybody. But that's in every single culture, and it's prevalent in law enforcement. So, do we have a long way to go? For sure. To make sure that, again, we're holding our folks accountable, getting them the training they need. Forcing them to actually look at themselves and the impact they're having on people in society, that they just can't just go out and not think about what their day's going to look like. You have to be proactive in your engagement, and that means that you're preparing before you go out on the road to engage someone, what that might look like, how you might respond. And if we're not looking and training people to go to that degree, we're missing the mark.
So this sounds like there's a messaging issue here. This is something lost in the marketing. because, again, we view the police and law enforcement as a monolith. So we see something happen in Minnesota. We see something happen in Philadelphia. It might as well have happened here. Immediately, we're affected. I remember when I got here in 2016, I believe Chief Outlaw, Outlaw was in place at that moment. There was a situation, there was a parade or some protests going on, and there were some members of a right-wing group that were on top of a parking structure, and they had firearms with them. And then there was a series of conversations that came out, text conversations that came out. And I remember being in the town hall, and the mayor was there, Chief Outlaw was there, a couple of members of city government were there. And the citizens were salty, upset, looking for some level of accountability. And just an explanation as to if we have members of law enforcement who are throwing up right-wing gang signs, have tattoos, in support of right-wing organizations, and are in community with right-wing organizations, to us, it's like, well, this is simple. Fire them. This is simple. These are people that should not be trusted to protect us, because they're communicating very clearly that they're only interested in protecting a section of the community. They could give a care about the rest of us. You spoke earlier about things that happened on the inside. And I'm not expecting you to have an answer with regards to that particular situation, what did or didn't happen. But what would you like to say to those of us that just feel like there's really simple answers and we seem to consistently get these complicated excuses as to why the right thing can't be done?
That's a complicated answer. That's a good question.
Okay.
Which I may not have an answer for today.
Got you.
But, you know, I think it, in essence, breaks down to not hiding behind the words, right? Mm-hmm. I think we, as leaders, tend to get long-winded and not be saying anything at all, right? Say what you mean. You know, to me, if there is fallout because you're trying, at least you're trying. That's why you're in the position. And our leaders need to be brave enough to step out to say, at this moment in time, this is what I believe or what we're trying to do. And maybe you're going to get it wrong, but tomorrow is another day. Mm-hmm. And most people are going to go, okay, well, at least you're trying, right? Mm-hmm. And holding people accountable, like you said, you got right-wing groups and left-wing groups. I mean, they're all out there, right? It goes both sides, right? Mm-hmm. So how do we bring people to the middle of understanding? And, you know, that's a Martin Luther King thing, is like, where do we find our, you know, we got our differences, but where do we find the commonality between all of us and say, can we live together, which I believe we can, but there's too many I statements going on, too many things going on where I'm going to protect myself and my interests. It's all about me. And when we are able to take me out of the equation, things tend to come together a little bit more. So that's what I'm about, is trying to take me out of it, right? And so I think we have a lot of room, a long way to go. But I think the essence of when we talk about black officers who represent the community, represent law enforcement, and how that looks, right, that is a difficult situation to be put in, right? And so I'm going down another trail, but I brought some BIPOC people, black folks together from across the metropolitan area after George Floyd got murdered. Mm-hmm. I thought, we need to unpack that. It was almost akin to the Twin Towers and the airplanes flying.
Yeah.
And I don't know what motion was coming out from you, but when I saw that on TV, I was like speechless.
I'm gonna tell you the truth. I couldn't watch it for a long time.
Yeah.
At that point, we were inundated with, you know, videos of law enforcement attacking members of our community.
Yeah.
So when that happened, I was like, I can't watch that.
Yeah.
It was heavy. It was heavy.
Yeah, extremely heavy. And so just think of it as a black officer who signed up to make a difference in the community, really make a difference in the community, mm-hmm. right? For their people, and seeing someone who represents them, who's white, on somebody's neck that represents them. Think about the double dynamic in that. And then answering to the community they belong to on top of it. Unpack that. That was tremendous for, I would imagine, every black officer in the country. How do we deal with that?
Right.
And am I making it? You know, we had officers that have been there for 20, 25, 30 years going, I don't even know if I've made a difference. I've been doing this for 30 years, and you're calling into question, what am I doing if this is happening? So it was a sobering effect, not only for the country and for minorities, but it was a sobering for black law enforcement officers having to hold in tandem being in a situation of law enforcement, but also knowing that you're representing a community that often calls you an Uncle Tom, the sellout, the whatever it might be. Mm-hmm. And now you put yourself in that situation like, what are we doing? What are we doing at the end of the day?
What's the point? Yeah. Without delving too much into the specifics of that particular interaction, how easy was it for you to see what happened and what shouldn't have happened? And like, was it just like open and closed? Like, okay, these aren't the procedures that we use. There is something happening here that is completely outside of the behavior of someone that's been trained. Like, how easy was that? Because I felt like it was a touch point, of course, for all of us, no matter what state you lived in. And people were on both sides of the conversation in something that felt like everyone should be on the same side here. It should be very easy to understand what happened here was wrong. Someone got murdered. How easy was that for you to just be like, and like, you know, trial for what? What are we doing?
So here it is where you're putting on like five different lenses.
Mm-hmm.
Law enforcement lens. What, you know, my pastor always said, don't just read the verse you're going to talk about and try to extrapolate and understand what happened. Mm-hmm. You need to read the two or three verses before.
Yep.
And two or three verses afterwards.
Yep.
And then you might get a perception, a concept of what's happening in that particular verse you're talking about, right?
Right.
So you're bringing lenses in, right? And so that's, I think, for black law enforcement officers, that's what they were doing. They could see training issues, training aspects.
Mm.
No, that should have never been done. Not unlike, and I'm not equating a death like that to sports, but, you know, we could, as an athlete, I can look at a game and go, dude, you shouldn't have done that.
Right.
How do you justify jacking up that at that particular moment in time? That's not the training. So there's a lot of aspects of society that you can kind of look at and go, yeah, I can apply and go, this was something that went terribly wrong. How come you couldn't check on the guy?
Mm.
He's telling you he can't breathe. It goes beyond the humanistic part of where did we lose ourselves in that aspect, and at certain points have we as black men and women in law enforcement been a part of that situation or could have been, right?
Mm.
So it really makes you take steps back to evaluate where you're at in this humanistic situation and situations you can get yourself into. And how are you going to now respond, even as a black person, right?
Yeah.
So I think we're continually to unpack, but that was a series called Standing Together to bring those folks together and say, hey, what were you thinking? And what did that look like? And what was the feeling at that point in time, like the Twin Tower incident?
Yeah.
Right? That was sobering.
Well,
so.
And how did that conversation go? I can't imagine it was easy.
There were people crying.
Right.
What am I doing? Mm. This is what I signed up for. This is not what I signed up for. You know, I thought it was extremely powerful. In words can't even express how people were able to kind of unpack what they were dealing with, and hopefully step out a little bit better to go out and be that much better when they're dealing with people in society that don't have the same opportunities, that are stuck in situations that they may have no choices or limited choices, limited resources, all kinds of limitations. And take me out of that situation. It's not all about what you think necessarily. How can I help you?
Right.
Right. And even in the midst, if I have to go on, have hands on, how can I be as humane as possible even in that situation? And if I lose my mind, like a lot of people do, my dad used to lose his mind all the time, with get that cord and
that switch
out. And I was like, man. And my mom would come in and go, hey, you know, you need to.
I think we're done.
Yeah, I think we're okay. But I mean, those are the those things that, as professionals, we have to have built into our policies and expectations of our members as law enforcement.
Yeah.
To say, hey, time out. Save that person for at that point in time. And, you know, it was unfortunate you had probationary people at officers that were in attendance at that particular time, mm-hmm. and felt powerless to do anything. We got to empower everyone from the top all the way down to the bottom, including our probationary officers, to be able to say, no, that's not right.
Right.
You got to empower them.
Right. You're making a lot of unpopular opinions right now.
What's
that? You're voicing a lot of unpopular opinions right now. I need you to know that. Accountability, what? So the immediate reaction to that from the nation at large was defund the police. The reaction was, okay, obviously they do not know what to do with the funding they have. There's these military budgets that are being rolled out. We got small towns with tanks. Like, defund the police. Reallocate the resources. When you first started hearing that, was it clear for you to understand what the motivations were and what the end goal of that was? Because so many people hear the statement and immediately it's like, you just want to take away our police. When the conversation really is, we would like to see some of these resources allocated in ways to give the police support, to give the community support, to lessen the amount of calls that law enforcement is asked to respond to. How was that for you, the defund the police conversation, as a black man watching that happen, and then also having a career in law enforcement and hearing the reaction from the inside?
So I got another perspective, right? Mm-hmm. I'm in the emergency operations room when that edict went down from the mayor.
Mm-hmm.
I'm from the sheriff's office. I get it. But you could see in that room, there's officers all the way up to command, that kind of deal. And it was like the air went out of the room.
Mm.
And these are mostly white people in there. And they're like, my existence, I am for the community, right? They were, and they felt like, what am I doing if I'm getting defunded and all the efforts I'm trying to do? And that's why I told you that 1%, 1 or 2%, yeah, that's there.
Mm-hmm.
But you have so many other people that were like, oh my gosh, this is a real hard process to really take hold of and go, what does that actually mean? And our community actually hates us.
Mm.
To have that kind of understanding at that point in time. And then, you know, the mayor says, you're done, basically, right? And so at that moment, of course, you're emotional and you're trying, you got to unpack that. And it's going to take days. People are still unpacking that, right?
Yeah.
What does that mean? And even within the context of the mayor doing that, he didn't understand how it was going to affect the black community, right? Because the very people he's trying to protect and answer to are the ones getting hurt because we can't get to calls.
Mm.
Even if it was, at least it was something, right? And so a lot of things came out of that. And I think for me to reflect on the defunding piece of it, for sure, it was a similar thought process right at that beginning and hearing that. Mm. But it also meant to me that what can we do? This is a call for us to do better.
Different.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
The community is saying, we're done with this. Right? So you better figure it out or we go figure it out for you, right?
Right.
But they should have been along for the ride regardless of even before that. So it gives if we of law enforcement don't get this at this moment, that we have to be more creative, more responsive, more inclusive, not less.
Mm-hmm.
And as we look at how we're serving the community, how do we change that? What are the components? Not being so shut down to the point where there's only one way, because that's a cultural issue that ends up within law enforcement, with any culture, I would say, a company, that they get locked and fixated on a one-dimensional way to do things, and all of a sudden it's so out of whack and out of alignment, because the world is continually changing.
Right.
Right? And if you're not changing with the world, with the community, and the people, you will get so far off base within a couple of years that you wouldn't even know who you are.
Right.
As you relate to the community. So it's incumbent that you have leaders and new leadership coming in through those processes to bring that lens in and say, "Hey, we need to shake it up again." And that's why it's important for the community to be part of that process, because we're moving at the speed of light in a lot of different ways. Mm. How things are changing so much, and police agencies are usually reactionary, not proactive.
Right.
Right.
Right. Right.
We got to get out of that.
Yeah.
You can't survive that way. And so, yeah, we're in a situation where we're in the fight for survival, because at this point, nobody wants to work as a police officer. Right. I can't get a youth, someone from high school to take a look at the possibility of coming on the road. How are we going to engage the youth differently? Because they see us a whole lot differently, whether true or not, it is the reality. And so we've fallen out of the top 10 of professions that people want to get into, barely cracking the top 30.
What's some of the pushback you get when you're engaging with youth and trying to get them interested in law enforcement as a career?
You talk to the wrong person, because I know how to relate to the youth.
Right. Yeah.
So I always get real good feedback. But, you know, what I love is they're honest about it.
Mm.
There is no
no sugarcoating
there.
Right.
Boom. And so I appreciate that perspective. I was at Central Catholic High School for a career day, and a couple people asked some questions. I was like, it was extremely refreshing. I was like, hey, let's talk about it. Let's go there. We didn't have a lot of time to unpack it, but I was like, We can talk afterwards, because if you're concerned, I'm concerned. If you are our future, they are our future.
Right.
And if we're not seeing it as that, the profession of policing is in trouble. It already is. It is in trouble.
I'm hearing you're clearly communicating a lot of the challenges that you face from a career standpoint, and just, you know, on the inside, and sharing in the understanding of the challenges we face as a community. With all of that having been said, what's the fountain that you dip into that restores your hope? Like, you're waking up in a very tense situation. You're going to work in a very tense situation. You're existing in the world as a black member of law enforcement in a very tense situation. What is it that you do? Where are you recharging? Where is your hope centered?
Well, I do have faith. That's my faith is a base, and that faith has increased through the years, through the last 20 years or so. That faith has been very pivotal for me. So I live for the one. And if that's the one, if that interaction that day, I get a positive one out of three or four or five that aren't, that one is the one I measure hope by. Because if I don't get any, hope starts to fade real fast, right? Mm-hmm. So I measure by the one. And it's on a day-by-day basis. And if I don't get one that day, the hope is I get it the next day, right? And so it's little bites, you know, the old adage of, you know, how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time, right? All those kind of adage goes in, but we always are looking at this big picture and we get overwhelmed. and somehow we need to bring ourselves back to a reality base of in a small measures versus the big mountain that you have to climb. Otherwise, it's going to be impossible, and you'll drive yourself crazy. Mm-hmm. So I try and center myself in that way.
Okay. Dipping back real quick to some of the challenges you face in trying to, you know, ascend the ranks and institutional racism and just those general difficulties. Something popped up in the news recently where I think it was said that you lack the qualifications for the position that you're seeking currently. What is your response to that? And is this what we're talking about? Is this the run-of-the-mill, you know, people slashing your tires and throwing out the spike strip? Is this just par for the course?
Well, it's par for my course, for sure.
Okay.
But how I've been having to deal with situations and issues. And it was interesting. I laid awake last night thinking about that process, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so when we talk about qualifications versus being certified.
Right.
It's two different things.
Okay.
So when we talk about being qualified for the situation, when I came into corrections, there was a qualification list.
Mm.
I met those qualifications and got hired. I didn't have the certificate yet.
But you had the qualifications.
I had the qualifications.
Right.
So the focus now is, are you certified? The focus should be, are you qualified?
Mm.
Right?
Mm.
So when you mix those words and confuse people to the extent of, well, are you certified? Well, most people who are getting a job don't have the certification.
They receive the certification after they, it's part of the training.
Huh. Well, it just dawned on me. I just had a epiphany and an aha moment. It's like, well, this is interesting. So
it's politics.
It is politics,
right?
And I get it. Hey, played very well. Okay,
right.
But at the end of the day, it's that is an element of racial or institutional racism.
Absolutely.
Right. If I can't have the opportunity to get certified like anybody else, like my competitor, you take people out before they even get a chance to get started. What happened to the qualifications?
Mm.
What happened to comparing who you are, what you've done, your life's work to get you to that point to say, I am qualified, and I'll get the certificate, right? So that's the crux of the argument. Oh yeah, she's got the certification. We can talk all day long how she got it and I didn't. The reality is it doesn't matter.
Mm.
I have the skill sets, I have the qualifications, I've done the work, and I would match those qualifications against anybody in the country and let the chips fall where they may lay.
With the amount of insight that you have because of your career, how long you've been in law enforcement, what are some of the differences you're looking to make?
One more time, I couldn't hear
you. Oh, I'm sorry. Again, we are, for anyone listening, we are live at the Welcome Dome in Pioneer Square. There are a lot of competing noises in the background. With your experience in law enforcement and some of the challenges you face, what are some of the differences you're looking to make with this new position?
Well, I think one of the biggest differences is to bring people out of their silos, right? So all too often we have people from Gresham, people from Portland who aren't talking.
Yeah.
Government officials who aren't talking. We're all dealing with the same issues.
Right.
Crime is sweeping from Portland to the east side, to the west side. It knows no zip code. It knows no boundaries. It doesn't matter, right?
Right.
So Multnomah County as a whole needs to come together. Community, organizations, law enforcement officials, the whole criminal justice system, DAs, judges, the judicial system, the probation and parole system. It's a systematic process that people need to sit down and bring to the table actionable items and how to fix the situation that we're in.
Right.
Because at this point, it's broken.
Okay.
And I liken it to, it's not just broken, it's fractured, because a fracture is worse than something being broken to that extent. Mm. We know a fracture is a lot harder to heal.
Final question. I feel like I've had you forever. Thank you for your time, first off. How important is the voice of black law enforcement?
We talked about Noble, and I said it's the consciousness of law enforcement. Because it sees so many sides of society that the average law enforcement officer doesn't see. That's what it brings. A voice, a calm, an understanding that is unrivaled. And do we have all the answers? No. But we come from a perspective from two separate communities and cultures that are colliding to that extent, right? We are of the culture, but not apart to an extent. We're of the culture within law enforcement, mm-hmm. not apart to an extent. We're of the culture of the black community, but not apart. That's what I'm talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And so we're having to tightrope this situation. And what we bring in is such a richness of our culture that understands it, understands what needs to be done. And like I said, it's not like we have all the answers, but that richness and quality that a person of color brings into a situation, specifically law enforcement, and if it's done the right way, if it's harnessed the right way, it can be explosive.
Having that organization and being able to exist in a state of calm and understanding within is one thing. What is the ideal relationship that black law enforcement wants to have with our community?
Ideally, what it needs to have, it really comes right back down to the simple process of having opportunities to have those conversations with our black community, with community members as a whole, but specifically have those open, frank conversations. How are we hurting each other? Mm. And not allowing us the opportunity to support each other through any of our endeavors to make this community better, and especially for those of color. And so we have to have our each other's back, and we need to be able to bring our white allies along with us. I know it didn't feel good it doesn't feel good when the finger's pointed at me, and I know it doesn't feel good when it's pointed at them.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we bring them alongside so they don't feel disenfranchised? Because, you know, I look at the situation with Martin Luther King. People were selling out, all Jewish people, white, from all different types of lifestyles and stuff. They were selling out because they felt a part of something. Mm. They felt like they were included. And they were willing to look at their own whiteness.
Mm.
And how it was affecting the whole situation.
Right.
So how do we get to that point where we bring everybody in together, where we can have that kind of conversation? And I believe people of color can have and bring that, offer that to our society.
There. Thank you for your time. I know you're a very busy man. Are there any words you'd like to leave our listeners with?
No, I think we've left it on the table.
Okay.
You know,
good.
I'm excited for Portland's future. I'm not getting ran out of town. Let's just put it that way. And I think more people need to have that attitude. And I totally understand if people are done and we got to pack up and go. But sometimes you have to put your tent tent pegs into the ground, and then begin to move those tent pegs out. So I think it's important that we stand our ground in that situation, in this situation where we're at, and hold our leaders accountable, especially hold them accountable to what needs to happen. Mm-hmm. Hold them accountable to make decisions and not just go along to get along.
Yeah.
Right? But make some they're in those positions to make difficult decisions, right?
Right. Right.
We didn't put them in there because it's a powder puff game and you're going to call a play and an audible and you're done and you win the game. No, it doesn't work that way. And so in hard times, it calls for hard decisions to be made. And they're not always going to be popular, but make the hard decisions and bring our community back. Not where it used to be, but better than it was.
Okay. Very well. Very well handled. I was like, oh. Very well. Thank you so much for your time. I want to thank everybody for tuning in live on Twitch. Again, hopefully you're listening to this and you're subscribed and followed to North of the Numbers, any of other podcasts on the podcast network. And, we'll catch you for the next episode. Peace.